Chapter 15. And they shall number 12, for 12 is a number which is pleasing to the gods. I know this to be true, for a raven once came to me in a dream and told me so. I have always loved the number 12, and it is for this reason that the gods have chosen me to reveal this truth to all the nations. Geryon scowled at the musty-smelling book. There had been some hope in the earlier pages, some obscure reference to light and dark, and a tantalizing fragment which had stated quite clearly that the holiest of things will always be the color of the sky, save only when it perceives great evil, and then will it burn hot with scarlet flame. When he had found that passage, he had read on avidly, convinced that he had stumbled across a genuine and hitherto undiscovered prophecy. The rest of the book, unfortunately, proved to be absolute gibberish. The brief biographical note at the beginning of the book indicated that its author had been a Drasnian merchant of some substance during the third millennium, and that these secret jottings had been found only after his death. Geryon wondered how a man with so disturbed a mind could have even functioned in a normal society. He closed the book in disgust, and added it to the growing pile of ravings that was accumulating on the table in front of him. Next, he picked up a slender volume that had been found in a deserted house in Arindia. The first few pages were devoted to the household accounts of a very minor Arindish nobleman. Then, on the fourth page, the mundane broke off quite suddenly. "The child of light shall take up the sword and go in search of that which is hidden." This was immediately followed by a tediously detailed account of the purchase of a dozen or so pigs from a neighbor. Then, once again, the unknown writer jumped into prophecy. "The quest of the child of light shall be for one whose soul has been reft away, for a stone that is empty at its center, and for the babe who will hold the light in one hand and the dark in the other." That definitely seemed to be getting somewhere. Geryon pulled one of his guttering candles closer and hunched over the book, reading each page carefully. Those two passages, however, proved to be the only ones in the entire volume that did not speak of the day-to-day business of that forgotten farm somewhere in Arindia. Geryon sighed. He leaned back and looked around at the dimly lighted library. The bound books stood in their dusty rows on the dark shelves, and the linen-covered scrolls lay along the top of each bookcase. The light of his two candles flickered, making the room seem almost to dance. "There's got to be a faster way to do this," he muttered. "Actually, there is," the dry voice in his mind said to him. "What?" "You said that there had to be a faster way. I said that there is." "Well, where have you been?" "Here and there." Geryon knew this other awareness well enough by now to be certain that it would tell him only what it wanted him to know. "All right. What is this faster way?"
"You don't have to read every single word the way you have been doing it. Open your mind and just leaf through the pages. The things I put in each book will sort of leap out at you."
"Are the prophecies always mixed right in with all of this other nonsense?"
"Usually, yes."
"Why did you do it that way?"
"Several reasons. Most of the time I did not want the man who was doing the actual writing even to know what I was hiding in his book. Then, of course, it is a good way to keep things from falling into unfriendly hands."
"And friendly ones, too, for that matter."
"Did you want me to explain? Or were you just looking for an excuse to make clever remarks?"
"All right," Geryon sighed, giving up.
"I think I've told you before that the word gives meaning to the event. The word has to be there, but it does not have to be right out in the open, where just anybody can find it."
Geryon frowned. "Do you mean that you put all of these things in all of these books just for a few people to read?"
The term a few isn't really accurate. Try one instead.
One? Well, who?
You, obviously.
Me? Why me?
Are we going to go through that again?
Are you trying to say that all of this was sort of like a personal letter just to me?
In a manner of speaking, yes.
What if I hadn't gotten around to reading it?
Why are you reading it now?
Because Belgarath told me to.
And why do you think Belgarath told you that?
Because, Garion broke off, you told him to say it to me.
Naturally. He didn't know about it, of course, but I nudged him. All sorts of people have access to the Mrin Codex. That's why I made it so cryptic. These personal instructions to you, however, should be fairly clear, if you pay attention.
Why don't you just tell me what I'm supposed to do?
I am not permitted to do that.
Permitted?
We have our rules, my opposite and I. We're very carefully balanced, and we have to stay that way. We agreed only to act through our instruments, and if I intervene in person, with such things as telling you directly what you must do, then my opposite will also be free to step over the line. That is why we both work through what are called prophecies.
Isn't that a little complicated?
The alternative would be absolute chaos. My opposite and I are limitless. If we confront each other directly, whole suns will be destroyed.
Garion shuddered and swallowed hard.
I didn't realize that, he admitted.
Then an idea occurred to him. Would you be permitted to tell me about that line in the Mrin Codex? The one that's got the blotted word in the middle of it?
That depends on how much you want to know about it.
What is the word under the blot?
There are several words there. If you look at it in the right kind of light, you should be able to see them. As for these other books, try reading them the way I told you to. I think you'll find that it saves a lot of time. And you really don't have all that much time to spare.
What's that supposed to mean?
But the voice was gone.
The door to the library opened and Zenedra came in, wearing her nightdress and a warm robe.
Garion,
she said,
aren't you ever coming to bed?
What? Oh, yes, right away.
Who was in here with you?
Nobody. Why?
I heard you talking to someone.
I was just reading, that's all.
Come to bed, Garion. You can't read this whole library in one evening.
Yes, dear, he agreed.
Not long after that, when spring had begun to touch the lower meadows on the slopes behind the citadel, the promised letter from King Anhag arrived. Garion immediately took the copy of that baffling passage in the Mrin Codex to the library to compare it with his copy. When he put the two side by side, he began to swear. Anheg's copy was blotted in exactly the same place.
I told him, Garion fumed. I told him specifically that I needed to see that particular spot. I even showed him.
Swearing angrily, he began to pace up and down, waving both arms in the air. Rather surprisingly, Zenedra took her husband's near obsession with the Mrin Codex in stride. Of course, the little queen's attention was almost totally riveted on her new son, and Garion was fairly certain that anything he said or did was only on the very edge of her awareness. Young Prince Garan was grossly overmothered. Zenedra held him in her arms almost every minute that he was awake, and frequently even when he was asleep. He was a good-natured baby, and seldom cried or fussed. He took his mother's constant attention quite calmly, and accepted all of the cuddling and cooing and impulsive kisses with equanimity.
Geryon, however, felt that Saenedra really overdid things just a bit. Since she insisted on holding Geryon constantly, it definitely cut into the time when he might be able to hold his son. Once he almost asked her when his turn was going to come, but decided at the last minute not to. The thing that he really felt was unfair was Tenedra's sense of timing. Whenever she did put Geryon in his cradle for a few moments and Geryon finally got the chance to pick him up, the little queen's hands seemed almost automatically to go to the buttons on the front of her dress, and she would placidly announce that it was time for Geryon to nurse. Geryon certainly did not begrudge his son his lunch, but the baby really didn't look all that hungry most of the time. After a time, however, when he finally became adjusted to Geryon's undeniable presence in their lives, the call of the dim, musty library began to reassert itself. The procedure that had been suggested to him by the dry voice worked surprisingly well. After a little practice, he found that he could skim rapidly over page after page of mundane material, and that his eye would stop automatically at the prophetic passages buried in the midst of ordinary text. He was surprised to find so many of these passages hidden away in the most unlikely of places. In most cases, it was obvious that the writers had not even been aware of what they had inserted. A sentence would frequently break off, leap into prophecy, and then take up again exactly where it had stopped. Geryon was positive that upon rereading the text, the unconscious prophet who had inserted the material would not even see what he had just written. The Mrin Codex, however, and to a lesser degree the Darin, remained the core of the whole thing. Passages from other works clarified or expanded, but the two major prophecies put it all down in uncontaminated form. Geryon began to cross-index as he went along, identifying each new passage with a number, and then linking those numbers to the series of letter codes he had assigned to the paragraphs of the Mrin scroll. Each paragraph of the Mrin, he discovered, usually had three or four corroborating or explanatory lines gleaned from other works, all except that crucial blotted passage.
"And how did the searching go today, dear?"
Saenedra asked brightly one evening, when he returned grouchy and out of sorts to the royal apartment. She was nursing Geryon at the time, and her face was aglow with tenderness as she held her baby to her breast. "I'm just about to give it all up," he declared, flinging himself into a chair. "I think it might be better just to lock up that library and throw away the key." She looked at him fondly and smiled.
"No, you know that wouldn't do any good, Geryon. You know that after a day or so, you wouldn't be able to stand it, and no door is so stout that you can't break it down."
"Maybe I should just burn all of the books and scrolls. I can't concentrate on anything else anymore. I know there's something hidden under that blot. Oh, but I can't find a single clue anywhere to what it might be."
"If you burn the library, Belgarath will probably turn you into a radish," she warned with a smile. "He's very fond of books, you know."
"It might be nice to be a radish for a while."
"It's really very simple, Geryon,"
she said with that infuriating placidity.
"Since all of the copies are blotted, why don't you go look at the original?"
He stared at her.
"It has to be somewhere, doesn't it?"
"Well, I suppose so, yes."
"Find out where it is, then, and go look, or send for it."
"I never thought of that."
"Obviously. It's much more fun to rant and rave and be unpleasant about it."
"You know, that's really a very good idea, Saenedra."
"Naturally. You men always want to complicate things so much. Next time you have a problem, dear, just bring it to me. I'll tell you how to solve it."
He let that pass. The first thing the following morning, Geryon went down into the city and called on the Raven Deacon in the Temple of Belar. The Raven Deacon was a sober-faced gentleman. Unlike the priests of Belar and the major temples on the continent, who were frequently more involved in politics than in the care of their flocks, the leader of the Riven Church concerned himself almost exclusively with the well-being,
physical as well as spiritual, of the common people. Geryon had always rather liked him.
"I've never actually seen it myself, Your Majesty,"
the deacon replied in response to Geryon's question.
"But I've always been told that it's kept in that shrine on the banks of the Mrin River, between the edge of the Finns and Boktor."
"Shrine?"
"The ancient Dresnians erected it on the site where the Mrin prophet was kept chained,"
the deacon explained.
"After the poor man died, King Bullneck directed that a memorial of some sort be put up there. They built the shrine directly over his grave. The original scroll is kept there in a large crystal case. A group of priests is there to protect it. Most people wouldn't be allowed to touch it, but considering the fact that you are the Riven King, I am sure that they will make an exception."
"Then it's always been there?"
"Except during the time of the Angrak invasion during the fourth millennium. It was taken by ship to Val'Alorn for safekeeping just before Boktor was burned. Torak wanted to get his hands on it, so it was felt wiser to get it out of the country."
"Makes sense," Geryon said. "Thank you for the information, Your Reverence."
"I am glad to be of help, Your Majesty."
It was going to be hard to get away. This week was completely out of the question since there was that meeting with the port authorities the day after tomorrow. And next week would be even worse. There were always so many official meetings and state functions. Geryon sighed as he climbed back up the long stairs to the citadel with his inevitable guard at his side. It somehow seemed that he was almost a prisoner here on this island. There were always so many demands on his time. He could remember a time, not really that long ago, when he started each day on horseback and seldom slept in the same bed two nights in a row. Upon consideration, however, he was forced to admit that even then he had not been free to do as he wished. Though he had not known it, this burden of responsibility had descended upon him on that windy autumn night so many years ago when he, Aunt Paul, Belgarath, and Durnick had crept through the gate at Faldor's farm and out into the wide world that lay before them.
"Oh, well," he muttered under his breath,
"this is important, too. Brand can manage here. They will just have to get along without me for a while."
"What was that, Your Majesty?"
the guard asked politely. "Oh, I'm just thinking out loud," Geryon replied, a little embarrassed. Tynedra seemed moody and out of sorts that evening. She held Geryon almost abstractedly, paying scant attention to him as he played with the amulet at her throat with a look of serious concentration on his face.
"What's the matter, dear?" Geryon asked her.
"Oh, just a headache, that's all. And a strange sort of ringing in my ears."
"You're tired."
"Maybe that's it. I think I will put Geryon in his cradle and go to bed. Maybe a good night's sleep will make me feel better."
"I can put him to bed."
"No,"
she said with a strange look.
"I want to be sure that he's safely in his cradle."
"Safe?" Geryon laughed. "Tynedra, this is Riva. It's the safest place in the world."
"Go tell that to Errol,"
she told him, and went into the small room adjoining their bedchamber, where Geryon's cradle stood. Geryon sat up and read until rather late that evening. Tynedra's restless moodiness had somehow communicated itself to him, and he did not really feel ready for bed. Finally, he put aside his book and went to the window to look out across the moon-touched waters of the Sea of the Winds, lying far below. Long, slow waves seemed almost like molten silver in the pale light, and their stately pace was oddly hypnotic. Finally, he blew out the candles and went quietly into the bedroom. Tynedra was tossing restlessly in her sleep and muttering half-formed phrases, meaningless snatches of fragmentary conversation. Geryon undressed and slipped into bed, trying not to disturb her.
"No,"
she said in a peremptory tone of voice.
"I won't let you do that."
Then she moaned and tossed her head on the pillow.
Geryon lay in the soft darkness listening to his wife talking in her sleep.
Geryon!
She gasped, coming suddenly awake.
Your feet are cold.
Oh, he said. Sorry. She drifted almost immediately back into sleep, and the muttering resumed. It was the sound of a different voice that woke him several hours later. The voice was oddly familiar, and Geryon lay still, almost asleep, trying to remember exactly where he had heard it before. It was a woman's voice, low and musical, and speaking in a peculiarly soothing tone. Then he suddenly realized that Synedra was not in the bed beside him, and he came fully awake instantly.
"But I have to hide him so they can't find him,"
he heard Synedra say in a strangely numb voice. He tossed back the covers and slid out of bed. A faint light gleamed through the open door to the nursery, and the voices seemed to be coming from there. Geryon moved quickly to the door, his bare feet making no sound on the carpet.
"Uncover your baby, Synedra," the other woman was saying, in a calm, persuasive voice. "You'll hurt him."
Geryon looked through the doorway. Synedra was standing by the cradle in her white nightdress, her eyes vacant and staring, with another figure beside her. On the chair at the foot of the cradle was a great heap of blankets and pillows. Dreamily, the Raven Queen was methodically piling the bedclothes on top of the baby.
"Synedra, stop. Listen to me." "I have to hide him," Synedra replied stubbornly. "They want to kill him." "Synedra, you will smother him. Now take all the blankets and pillows out again." "But do as I said, Synedra," the woman said firmly. "Now..."
Synedra made a little whimpering sound and began to remove the bedding from the cradle.
"That's better. Now listen to me. You must ignore him when he tells you things like this. He is not your friend."
Synedra's face grew puzzled.
"He isn't?" "He's your enemy. He is the one who wants to hurt Geryon." "My baby?" "Your baby's all right, Synedra, but you have to fight this voice that comes to you in the night."
"Who?" Geryon started, but then the woman turned to look at him, and he broke off, his mouth agape with astonishment. The woman had tawny-colored hair and warm golden eyes. Her dress was plain and brown, almost earth-colored. Geryon knew her. He had met her once before on the moors of eastern Drasnia, when he and Belgarath and Silk had been on their way to that dreadful meeting in the haunted ruins of Tol Mishrak. Aunt Paul's mother closely resembled her daughter. Her face had that same calm, flawless beauty, and her head that same proud, erect carriage. There was about this timeless face, however, a strange, almost eternal kind of regret that caught at Geryon's throat.
"Poledra! What?"
Aunt Paul's mother put one finger to her lips.
"Don't wake her, Belgarion. Let's get her back to bed." "Geryon, he's all right. I arrived in time. Just lead her gently back to bed. She will sleep now without any more of these adventures."
Geryon went to his wife's side and put his arm about her shoulders.
"Come along now, Synedra,"
he said gently to her. She nodded, her eyes still vacant, and obediently went with him back into the royal bedroom.
"Could you pull back that bolster for me?"
he quietly asked Poledra. She laughed.
"As a matter of fact, I cannot. You forget that I'm not really here, Belgarion." "Oh, I'm sorry. It just seemed..."
He pushed the bolster out of the way, carefully laid Synedra into the bed and pulled the coverlets up around her chin. She sighed and snuggled down to sleep.
"Let's go into the other room," Poledra suggested.
He nodded and quietly followed her into the adjoining room, which was still dimly lighted by the glowing embers of the dying fire.
"What was that all about?"
he asked softly, closing the door.
"There is someone who hates and fears your son, Belgarion,"
she told him gravely.
"But he's only a baby,"
Geryon protested.
His enemies fear him for what he may become, not for what he is now. It has happened that way before, you will recall. You mean when Asherak killed my parents?
She nodded.
He was actually trying to get at you. But how can I protect Garen from his own mother? I mean, if this man can come to Tenedra in her sleep like that and make her do things, how can I possibly...
It will not happen again, Belgarion. I took care of that.
But how could you? I mean, you're... well...
dead? Oh, that's not altogether accurate. But no matter. Garen is safe for the moment, and Tenedra won't do this again. There is something else we need to discuss.
All right.
You're getting very close to something important. I can't tell you everything. But you do need to look at the Mrin Codex. The real one, not one of the copies. You must see what's hidden there.
I can't leave Tenedra, not now. She's going to be all right. And this is something that only you can do. Go to that shrine in the River Mrin and look at the Codex. It is desperately important.
Garion squared his shoulders.
All right. I'll leave in the morning.
One other thing.
What?
You must take the orb with you.
The orb? You won't be able to see what you have to see without it.
I don't quite understand.
You will, when you get there.
All right, Poledra.
He made a rueful face.
I don't know why I'm objecting. I've been doing things I didn't understand all my life now.
Everything will come clear in time,
she assured him.
Then she looked at him rather critically.
Garion,
she said in a tone so like Aunt Paul's that he answered automatically.
Yes? You really shouldn't run around at night without a robe, you know. You will catch cold.
The ship he hired at Kotu was small, but well designed for river travel. It was a shallow-draft, broad-beamed little ship that sometimes bobbed like a chip of wood. The oarsmen were sturdy fellows, and they made good time rowing against the sluggish current of the Mrin River as it meandered its slow way through the fens. By nightfall, they were 10 leagues upriver from Kotu, and the captain prudently moored his ship to a dead snag with one of the tar-smeared hawsers.
"It's not a good idea to try to find the channel in the dark," he told Garion. "One wrong turn, and we could spend the next month wandering around in the fens."
"You know what you're doing, Captain," Garion told him. "I'm not going to interfere."
"Would you like a tankard of ale, Your Majesty?"
the captain offered.
"Well, that might not be a bad idea," Garion agreed. Later, he leaned against the railing with his tankard in hand, watching the darting lights of the fireflies and listening to the endless chorus of the frogs. It was a warm spring night, and the damp, rich odor of the fens filled his nostrils. He heard a faint splash, a fish maybe, or perhaps a diving otter.
"Belgarion?"
It was a strange, piping kind of voice, but it was quite distinct. It was also coming from the other side of the railing. Garion peered out into the velvet darkness.
"Belgarion?"
The voice came again, somewhere below him.
"Yes,"
Garion answered cautiously.
"I need to tell you something."
There was another small splash, and the ship rocked slightly. The hawsers that moored her to the snag dipped, and a scampering shadow ran quickly up it and slid over the railing in a curiously fluid way. The shadow stood up, and Garion could clearly hear the water dripping from it. The figure was short, scarcely more than 4 feet tall, and it moved toward Garion with a peculiarly shuffling gait.
"You are older,"
it said.
"That happens," Garion replied, peering at the form as he tried to make out its face.
Then the moon slid out from behind a cloud, and Garion found himself staring directly into the furry, wide-eyed face of a fenling.
"Tupik?"
he asked incredulously.
"Is that you?"
"You remember?"
The small furry creature seemed pleased.
"Well, of course I remember."
The ship rocked again,
and another furry shadow ran up to the hawsers. Tupik turned with irritation.
Bobby,
he chittered angrily.
Go home.
No,
she answered quite calmly.
You must do as I say,
he told her, stamping his feet on the deck.
Why?
Tupik stared at her in obvious frustration.
Are they all like that?
He demanded of Geryon.
All what?
Females,
Tupik said the word with a certain disgust. Most of them, yes. Tupik sighed.
How is Vordai?
Geryon asked them. Poppy made a peculiarly disconsolate whimpering sound.
Our mother is gone,
she said sadly.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
She was very tired,
Tupik said.
We covered her with flowers,
Poppy said.
Then we closed up her house.
She would have liked that.
She said that one day you would come back. She was very wise,
said Tupik.
Yes, he told them both.
She said that we should wait till you came. Then we were to give you a message.
Oh?
There is an evil that moves against you.
I was beginning to suspect that.
Mother said to tell you that the evil has many faces, and that the faces do not always agree. But that which is behind it has no face, and that it comes from much farther than you think.
I don't quite follow.
It is from beyond the stars.
Geryon stared at him.
That is what we were told to see,
Poppy assured him.
Tupik said it exactly as Mother told him to.
Tell Belgaroth about Mother,
Tupik said then.
And tell him that she sent him her thanks.
I will.
Goodbye, Belgaroth,
the Finling said. Poppy made a small, affectionate sound in her throat, pattered over and nuzzled briefly at Geryon's hand. Then the two of them slipped over the side and vanished in the dark waters of the Fen. Chapter 16. It was a dreary-looking place. The village huddled on the riverbank at the edge of a flat and featureless plain covered with coarse, dark green grass. The underlying soil was alluvial clay, slick, gray, unwholesome-looking, and just beyond the wide bend in the Mrenn River lay the endless green and brown expanse of the Fens. The village itself consisted of perhaps 24 dun-colored houses huddled all together about the square stone structure of the shrine. Rickety docks, constructed of bone-white driftwood, stuck out into the river like skeletal fingers, and fishing nets hung on poles drying and smelling in the humid, mosquito-infested air. Geryon's ship arrived about noon, and he went immediately up from the creaking dock along the muddy, rutted street to the shrine itself. Walking carefully to avoid slipping and feeling the curious stares of the dull-eyed villagers directed toward him, and at the great sword of the Riven King strapped to his back. The priests of Belar who guarded the shrine were obsequious, almost fawning, when he arrived at the tarnished bronze gates and requested entry. They led him through a flagstone-covered courtyard, pointing proudly at the rotting kennel and the stout, tar-smeared post with its fragment of heavy, rusting chain where the mad prophet of Mrenn had spent his last days. Within the shrine itself stood the customary altar with its great carved stone bear head. Geryon noted that the interior of the shrine stood in need of a good cleaning, and that the priest guardians themselves were rumpled and unwashed. One of the first manifestations of religious enthusiasm, he had noted, was a powerful aversion to soap and water. Holy places, and those who attended them, always seemed to smell bad. There was some small problem when they reached the vaulted sanctorium, where the yellowed parchment scroll of the original Mrenn Codex lay in its crystal case with 2 man-high candles flanking it. One of the priests, a wild-eyed fanatic whose hair and beard resembled a wind-ravaged straw stack, objected shrilly, almost hysterically, when Geryon politely requested that the case be opened. The ranking priest, however, was enough of a politician to recognize the preeminent claim of the Riven King, particularly since he bore Aldur's orb, to examine any holy object that he pleased. Garion realized once again that, in a peculiar way, he himself was a holy object in the minds of many Aelorns. The fanatic at last retreated, muttering the word blasphemy over and over again. The crystal case was opened with a rusty iron key, and a small table and chair were brought into the circle of candlelight so that Garion might examine the codex. "I think I can manage now, your reverences," he told them rather pointedly. He did not like having people read over his shoulder, and he felt no particular need of company. He sat at the table, put his hand on the scroll, and looked directly into the little clot of priests. "I'll call if I need anything." Their expressions were disapproving, but the overpowering presence of the Riven King made them too timid to protest his peremptory dismissal. They quietly filed out, leaving him alone with the scroll. Garion was excited. The solution to the problem that had plagued him for all of these months lay at last in his hands. With nervous fingers, he untied the silken cord and began to unroll the cracking parchment. The script was archaic, but gorgeously done. The individual letters had not so much been written as they had been meticulously drawn. He perceived almost at once that an entire lifetime had been devoted to the production of this single manuscript. His hands actually trembling with his eagerness, Garion carefully unrolled the scroll, his eyes running over the now familiar words and phrases, searching for the line that would once and for all clear up the mystery. And there it was. Garion stared at it incredulously, not believing what he saw. The blot was exactly the same as it was on all of the copies. He almost screamed in frustration. With a sick feeling of defeat, he read once again that fatal line. "And the child of light shall meet with the child of dark and shall overcome him, and the darkness shall flee. But behold, the stone which lies at the center of the light shall..." And there was that accursed blot again. A peculiar thing happened as he read it again. An odd sort of indifference seemed to come over him. Why was he making such a fuss about a single blotted word? What difference could one word make? He almost rose from his chair with the intention of putting the scroll back in its case and leaving this foul-smelling place for home. Then he stopped quite suddenly, remembering all of the hours he had spent trying to puzzle out the meaning of that blot on the page. Perhaps it wouldn't hurt to read it one more time. He had, after all, come a very long way. He started over again, but his distaste became so acute that he could hardly stand it. Why was he wasting his time with this nonsense? He had traveled all of this way to wear out his eyes on this moldering scrap of insane gibberish, this stinking, half-rotten sheet of poorly tanned sheepskin. He shoved the codex away in disgust. This was sheer idiocy. He pushed back the chair and stood up, shifting Iron Grip's great sword on his back. His ship would still be there, moored to that rickety dock. He could be halfway to Kattu by nightfall, and back at Riva within the week. He would lock the library once and for all and tend to his business. A king, after all, did not have time for all of this idle, brain-sickly speculation. Decisively, he turned his back on the scroll and started toward the door. As soon as he was no longer looking at the scroll, however, he stopped. What was he doing? The puzzle was still there. He had made no effort to solve it. He had to find out. But as he turned back and looked at the scroll again, that same wave of insupportable disgust almost overwhelmed him. It was so strong that it made him feel faint. Once again he turned his back, and once again the feeling vanished. There was something about the scroll itself that was trying to drive him away. He began to pace up and down, carefully keeping his eyes away from the scroll. What had the dry voice in his mind told him? There are several words there. If you look at them in the right kind of light, you should be able to see them. What kind of light? The candles in this vaulted room obviously were not what the voice had meant. Sunlight? Well, that hardly seemed likely. Poledra had said that he must read the hidden words, but how could he, when the codex literally drove him away each time he looked at it? Then he stopped. What else had she said? Something about not being able to see without... The waves of disgust which struck him was so strong that he felt his stomach constricting. He spun quickly so that his back was toward that hateful document. As he did so, the hilt of Iron Grip's sword jabbed him painfully in the side of the head. Angrily, he reached over his shoulder to grasp the handle and push it back, but instead his hand touched the orb. The feeling of revulsion evaporated instantly, and his mind became clear, his thoughts lucid. The light. Of course. He had to read the codex by the light of the orb. That is what both Poledra and the dry voice had been trying to tell him. Awkwardly, he reached up and back, seizing the orb. "Come off," he muttered to it. With a faint click, the orb came free in his hand. The sudden weight of the huge sword strapped across his back very nearly drove him to his knees. In astonishment, he realized that the seeming weightlessness of the great weapon had been the work of the orb itself. Struggling under that gross weight, he fumbled with the buckle at his chest, unfastened it, and felt the enormous bulk slide free. Iron Grip's sword fell to the floor with a loud clatter. Holding the orb in front of him, Geryon turned and looked directly at the scroll. He could almost hear an angry snarl hovering in the air, but his mind remained clear. He stepped to the table and pulled the scroll open with one hand, holding the glowing orb above it with the other. At last he saw the meaning of the blot that had frustrated him for so long. It was not some random splotch of spilled ink. The message was there, all of it. But the words had all been written down on top of one another. The entire prophecy lay in that one single spot. By the blue unwavering light of Aldur's orb, his eyes seemed actually to plunge down and down beneath the surface of the parchment, and the words hidden for aeons rose like bubbles out of the substance of the scroll. But behold, the stone which lies at the center of the light shall burn red, and my voice shall speak unto the child of light and reveal the name of the child of dark. And the child of light will take up the guardian's sword and go forth to seek out that which is hidden. Long will be his quest, and it shall be threefold. And you shall know that the quest hath begun when the keeper's line is renewed. Guard well the seed of the keeper, for there shall be no other. Guard it well, for should that seed fall into the hands of the child of dark, and be taken to the place where the evil dwells, then blind choice alone can decide the outcome. Should the keeper's seed be reft away, then must the beloved and the eternal lead the way, and he shall find the path to the place where the evil dwells in the mysteries. And in each mystery shall lie but a part of the path, and he must find them all, or the path will lead awry, and the dark shall triumph. Hasten, therefore, to the meeting where the threefold quest will end. And this meeting will come to pass in a place which is no more, and there will be the choice made. Geryon read it again, then a third time, feeling an ominous chill as the words echoed and thundered through his consciousness. Finally, he rose and went to the door of the candlelit vaulted chamber. "I'll need something to write with," he told the priest standing just outside. "And send someone down the river. Have him tell the captain of my ship to get things ready. Just as soon as I finish here, I have to leave for Katu." The priest was staring wide-eyed at the incandescently glowing orb in Geryon's hand. "Well, don't just stand there, man. Move. The whole world's hanging on this." The priest blinked, then scurried away. The following day, Geryon was in Kotu, and about a day and a half later he reached Alderford in northern Algeria. As luck had it, he heard of half-wild Algerian cattle was being driven across that wide, shallow place in the mighty river on their way to Muros, and Geryon went immediately in search of the herdmaster. "I'm going to need 2 horses, he said, skipping the customary courtesies. "The best you have. I have to be in the Vale of Alder before the week is out." The herdmaster, a fierce-looking Algar warrior in black leather, looked at him speculatively.
"Good horses are expensive, Your Majesty," he ventured, his eyes coming alight.
"That's beside the point. Please have them ready in 1/4 hour, and throw some food in a saddlebag for me."
"Doesn't Your Majesty even want to discuss the price?"
The herdmaster's voice betrayed his profound disappointment. "Not particularly," Geryon told him. "Just add it all up. I'll pay it." The herdmaster sighed.
"Take them as a gift, Your Majesty."
He looked mournfully at the Riven King.
"You do realize, of course, that you have absolutely ruined my whole afternoon."
Geryon gave him a tight, knowing grin. "If I had the time, good herdmaster, I'd haggle with you for the whole day, right down to the last penny, but I have urgent business in the south." The herdmaster shook his head sadly. "Oh, don't take it so hard, my friend," Geryon told him. "If you like, I'll curse your name to everyone I meet and tell them all how badly you cheated me." The herdmaster's eyes brightened.
"That would be extremely kind of Your Majesty," he said.
He caught Geryon's amused look.
"One does have a certain reputation to maintain, after all. The horses will be ready whenever you are. I will select them for you myself."
Geryon made good time as he galloped south. He kept his horses fresh and strong by changing mounts every 2 or 3 leagues. The long journey in quest of the orb had taught him many ways to conserve the strength of a good horse, and he utilized them all. When a steep hill stood in his path, he slowed to a walk and made up the lost time on the long downhill slope on the other side. When he could, he went around rough terrain. He stopped for the night and was on the move again at first light in the morning. Steadily he moved south through the knee-high sea of waving prairie grass, lying lush and green under the warm spring sun. He avoided the man-made mountain of the Algerian stronghold, knowing that King Kohag and Queen Silar, and certainly Hetar and Adara, would insist that he stop over for a day or so. Regretfully, he also passed a league or so to the west of Poledra's cottage. He hoped that there would be time later to visit Aunt Paul, Durnick, and Erend. Right now, he had to get to Belgaroth with a passage of the codex he had so carefully copied, and which now rode in the inside pocket of his doublet. When at last he arrived at Belgaroth's squat round tower, his legs were so tired that they trembled under him as he swung down from his lathered horse. He went immediately to the large flat-faced rock that was the door to the tower.
"Grandfather!"
he shouted at the windows above.
"Grandfather, it's me!"
There was no answer. The squat tower loomed silently up out of the tall grass, etched sharply against the sky. Geryon had not even considered the possibility that the old man might not be there.
"Grandfather!"
he called again. There was still no answer. A red-winged blackbird swooped in, landed atop the tower, and peered curiously down at Geryon. Then it began to preen its feathers. Almost sick with disappointment, Geryon stared at the silent rock that always swung aside for Belgaroth. Although he knew that it was a serious breach of etiquette, he pulled in his concentration, looked at the rock, and said, "Open." The stone gave a startled little lurch and swung obediently aside. Geryon went in and quickly mounted the stairs, remembering at the last instant to step over the one where the loose stone lay still unrepaired.
"Grandfather!"
he called up the stairway.
"Geryon?"
The old man's voice, coming from above, sounded startled.
"Is that you?"
"I called," Geryon said, coming into the cluttered round room at the top of the stairs. "Didn't you hear me?"
"I was concentrating on something," the old man replied. "What's the matter? What are you doing here?"
I finally found that passage, Geryon told him.
What passage?
The one in the Mrin Codex, the one that was missing. Belgarath's expression grew suddenly tense, even wary.
What are you talking about, boy? There is no missing passage in the Mrin Codex.
We talked about it at Riva. Don't you remember? It's the place where there's a blot on the page. I pointed it out to you.
Belgarath's look grew disgusted.
You came here and interrupted me over that?
His tone was scathing.
Geryon stared at him. This was not the Belgarath that he knew. The old man had never treated him so coldly before.
Grandfather, what's wrong with you? This is very important. Somebody has somehow obscured a part of the Codex. When you read it, there's a part you don't see.
But you can see it,
Belgarath said in a voice filled almost with contempt.
You? A boy who couldn't even read until he was almost grown? The rest of us have been studying that Codex for thousands of years, and now you come along and tell us that we have been missing something?
Listen to me, Grandfather. I'm trying to explain. When you come to that place, something happens to your mind. You don't pay any attention to it because for some reason you don't want to.
Nonsense, Belgarath snorted. I don't need some rank beginner trying to tell me how to study.
Won't you at least look at what I found? Geryon begged, taking the parchment out of his inside pocket and holding it out.
No, Belgarath shouted, slapping the parchment away. Take that nonsense away from me. Get out of my tower, Geryon.
Grandfather.
Get out of here.
The old man's face was pale with anger, and his eyes flashed. Geryon was so hurt by his grandfather's words that tears actually welled up in his eyes. How could Belgarath talk to him this way? The old man became even more agitated. He began to pace up and down, muttering angrily to himself.
I have to work. Things to do. Important work. And you come bursting in here with this wild tale about something being missing. How dare you? How dare you interrupt me with this idiocy? Don't you know who I am?
He gestured at the parchment Geryon had picked up and was holding again.
Get that disgusting thing out of my sight.
And then Geryon suddenly understood. Whatever, or whoever it was that was trying to conceal the words hidden in that strange blot of ink, was growing desperate, driving Belgarath into this uncharacteristic rage to keep him from reading the passage. There was only one way to break that strange compulsion not to see. Geryon laid the parchment on the table, then coldly and deliberately unbuckled the heavy belt running across his chest, removed Iron Grip's sword from his back, and stood it against the wall. He put his hand to the orb on the pommel of the sword and said,
"Come off."
The orb came free in his hand, glowing at his touch.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm going to have to make you see what I'm talking about, Grandfather. I don't want to hurt you, but you have to look."
He walked slowly and deliberately toward Belgarath, the orb extended before him.
"Geryon," Belgarath said, backing away apprehensively. "Be careful with that."
"Go to the table, Grandfather," Geryon told him grimly. "Go to the table and read what I found."
"Are you threatening me?"
Belgarath demanded incredulously.
"Just do it, Grandfather."
"We don't have to behave this way toward each other, Geryon," the old man said, still backing away from the glowing orb.
"The table," Geryon repeated. "Go over there and read."
Sweat was standing out on Belgarath's forehead. Reluctantly, almost as if it were causing him some obscure kind of pain, he went to the table and bent over the parchment sheet. Then he shook his head.
"I can't see it," he declared, though a burning candle stood right beside the sheet. "It's too dark in here."
"Here," Geryon said, reaching forth with the glowing orb. "I'll light it for you."
The orb flared, and its blue light fell across the sheet and filled the room.
"Read it, Grandfather."
Belgarath stared at him with an almost pleading expression.
"Geryon,
read it."
Belgarath dropped his eyes to the page lying before him, and suddenly he gasped.
Where? How did you get this?
It was under that blot. Can you see it now?
Well, of course I can see it.
Excitedly, Belgarath picked up the sheet and read it again. His hands were actually trembling.
Are you sure this is exactly what it said?
I copied it word for word, Grandfather, right off of the original scroll.
How were you able to see it?
The same way you are, by the light of the orb. Somehow it makes it clear.
Astonishing, the old man said. I wonder.
He went quickly to a cabinet standing by the wall, rummaged around for a moment, and then came back to the table with a scroll in his hands. He quickly unrolled it.
Hold the orb closer, boy.
Geryon held out the orb and watched his grandfather as the buried words slowly rose to the surface, just as they had in the shrine.
Absolutely amazing,
Belgarath marveled.
It's blurred. Some of the words aren't clear. But it's there. It's all there. How is it possible that none of us noticed this before? How did you discover it?
I had help, Grandfather. The voice told me that I had to read it in a certain kind of light. He hesitated, knowing how much pain what he had to say would cause the old man. And then Poledra came to visit us.
Poledra?
Belgarath spoke his wife's name with a little catch in his voice. Someone was making Tenedra do something in her sleep, something very dangerous, and Poledra came and stopped her. Then she told me that I had to go to the shrine in Drasnia and read the codex, and she specifically told me to take the orb along. When I got there and started reading, I almost laughed. It all seemed too stupid somehow. Then I remembered what they had told me, and I put it together. As soon as I started reading by the light of the orb, that feeling that I was wasting my time disappeared. Grandfather, what causes that? I thought it was only me, but it affected you too.
Belgarath thought a moment, frowning. It was an interdiction, he explained finally. Someone at some time put his will to that one spot, and made it so repulsive that no one could even see it.
But it's right there, even on your copy. How is it that the scribe who copied it could see it well enough to write it down, but we could not?
Many of the scribes in the old days were illiterate, Belgarath explained. You don't have to be able to read in order to copy something. All those scribes were doing was drawing exact duplicates of the letters on the page.
But this... what was it you called it?
Interdiction. It is a fancy word for what happens. I think Belden invented it. He's terribly impressed by his own cleverness sometimes.
The interdiction made the scribes pile all of the words on top of each other, even though they didn't know what the words meant?
Belgarath grunted, his eyes lost in thought. Whoever did this is very strong, very subtle. I didn't even suspect that someone was tampering with my mind.
When did it happen?
Probably at the same time the Mrin prophet was speaking the words originally.
Would the interdiction keep working after the person who caused it was dead?
No.
Then?
Right. He's still around somewhere.
Could it be this Zandramas we keep hearing about?
It's possible, I suppose.
Belgarath picked up the sheet Geryon had copied.
I can see it by ordinary light now. Apparently, once you break the interdiction for somebody, it stays broken.
He carefully read the sheet again.
This is really important, Geryon.
I was fairly sure that it was. I don't understand it all, though. The first part is fairly simple. The part about the orb turning red and the name of the Child of Dark being revealed. It sort of looks as if I'm going to have to make another one of those trips.
It's a long one, if this is right.
What is the next part meaning?
Well, as nearly as I could make it out, this quest of yours, whatever it is, has already started. It began when Geryon was born. I don't like this part that says that blind choice might make the decision, though. That's the sort of thing that makes me very nervous.
Who is the Beloved and the Eternal?
Probably me.
Geryon looked at him.
Belgarath shrugged.
It is a little ostentatious, he admitted. But some people do call me the Eternal Man. And when my master changed my name, he added the syllable Bel to my old one. In the old language, Bel meant beloved.
He smiled a bit sadly.
My master had a way with words, sometimes.
What are these mysteries it talks about?
It is an archaic term. In the old days, they used the word mystery instead of prophecy. As cryptic as some of them are, it sort of makes sense, I guess.
Hor Geryon! Hor Belgarath!
The voice came to them from outside the tower.
Who is that?
Belgarath asked.
Did you tell anyone you were coming here?
No,
Geryon frowned. Not really. He went to the window and looked down. A tall, hawk-faced Algar with a flowing black scalp lock sat astride a lathered and exhausted-looking horse.
Hetar, Geryon called down to him. What's the matter?
Let me in, Geryon. I have to talk with you.
Belgarath joined Geryon at the window.
The door's around on the other side, he called down. I'll open it for you. Be careful of the stone on that fifth step,
he cautioned as the tall man started around the tower.
It's loose.
When are you going to fix that, grandfather?
Geryon asked. He felt the faint, familiar surge as the old man opened the door.
Oh, I'll get to it one of these days.
Hetar's hawk-like face was bleak as he came up into the round room at the top of the tower.
What's all the urgency, Hetar? I've never seen you ride a horse into the ground like that.
Hetar took a deep breath.
You have got to go back to Riva immediately, Geryon.
Is something wrong there? Geryon asked, a sudden chill coming over him.
Hetar sighed.
I hate to be the one to have to tell you this, Geryon. But Synedra sent word for me to get you as fast as I possibly could. You have got to go back to Riva at once.
Geryon steeled himself, a dozen dreadful possibilities arising in his imagination.
Why? He asked quietly.
I am sorry, Geryon. More sorry than I can possibly say. But Brand has been murdered.